Over the next 6 years, the minimum wage in Illinois will almost double. By 2025, it will be $15 an hour throughout the entire state. Some businesses aren't happy, but how much will this help working families? Plus, Governor Pritzker is delivering his first budget address tomorrow. He'll have to address some tough realities when it comes to our fiscal situation. And there have been more than 120 cases of measles in the U.S. since the beginning of this year. Over the last few days, four of them have been confirmed in Urbana.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, Governor Pritzker is delivering his first budget address tomorrow. As a reminder, we'll be broadcasting live from the state capitol in a special edition of the 21st. We'll be speaking with lawmakers beforehand, then bringing you the budget address live and some analysis afterwards if we have time. While Illinois might have a new state government, we've got some longstanding financial problems. And later this hour, the Civic Federation will join us to talk about the changes that they see as difficult but necessary. Also coming up, people around the world are dying of measles, even though it's easy to prevent with a vaccine. There have been, in the U.S., nearly 130 cases of the measles, including four cases right here in Illinois. We'll speak with Carr Foundation Dr. David Chan, who will explain what's going on with the four cases that have popped up in Champaign-Urbana. But first, years of advocacy strikes and rallies for a higher minimum wage have paid off from supporters across the state. Last week, the Illinois House passed a measure to increase the state minimum wage from $8.25 an hour to $15 an hour by 2025. As we speak, Governor J.B. Pritzker is signing that bill into law in the governor's mansion. This move will make Illinois the first state in the Midwest and the fifth nationally to have a $15 minimum wage. Nationwide calls to raise the minimum wage also haven't gone unheard. Democrats in Congress have introduced a bill that would establish a $15 federal minimum wage. Advocates here in Illinois say the increase will help ease the burden on working families, while critics are wary of the impact it might have on business. We've been asking you on social media what you think about it. Mark in Springfield says it will be difficult, but there is no way a worker should only earn around $17,000 working full time. Leon in Crawford County says this will drive small businesses out of Illinois. We're going to talk to lots of folks about this, starting with Rob Carr, President and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Rob, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks again, Nyla. Good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if you can just share your thoughts. I know the Retail Merchants Association was very disappointed in this process and how all of this came out.
Yeah, I think disappointment's the right word, and it continues today. I think the fact that there was not a sensitivity to suburban and downstate employers, that they weren't given the same consideration that Chicago employers have been given, that the tax credit is not really truly effective, and that it will cause substantial harm to particularly suburban and downstate employers, is something that we all should be worried about. It impacts tax receipts not only for the state and local governments, but it impacts opportunity as well for citizens, particularly downstate.
And when you say that it was suburban and downstate was not given the same consideration as Chicago, what do you mean?
Well, Chicago started increasing its minimum wage in 2015. So by the time you fully implement Senate Bill 1, Chicago employers will have had 10 years to go from $8.25 to $15. Suburban and downstate employers are being given five, and half the time. And they do not have, no other place in the state of Illinois has the same strengths as the city of Chicago. No one else has over 55 million tourists a year. No one else has millions of people going into their downtown every day for work and spending money. No one else has the critical mass of business headquarters and wealth.
So the idea that this would, so this is the way this works, is this would add a dollar. So it's $8.25 right now. Next year would go to $9.25 in January, then $10 an hour in July, and then a dollar every year after that. That you do not think is enough a cushion for example, your retail members.
Correct. Certainly not for suburban and downstate members. It just ignores the economic diversity and the economic realities of the state of Illinois versus the city of Chicago.
And in terms of retail statewide, I wonder what kind of effects you will see from this or what you're concerned about seeing effects.
I think we're going to see everything across the board. I will tell you, Nyla, I've been doing this 25 years this year. I have never before in all of that time had particularly small retailer members calling me at night in tears or near tears because they have done the math and they believe they are gone. They don't believe they can make it work. I have had others who said, well, retirement's gone, insurance gone, and I don't know if I can make it work. So we're going to see hours cut, benefits cut. You're going to see some places close. You're going to see other places move. You know, we had two manufacturing facilities who had indicated they're going to relocate their lines or a good portion of their lines, one to Indiana and one to Missouri. So I think you're just going to see a broad range of effects. There's not going to be one response to any of this.
And Rob, certainly that sounds like it's really difficult to get those calls. I wonder, though, when you talk to economists about this and they look at how this has been implemented in other places, they haven't necessarily always seen what you've described.
Well, but I think we also have to, what is not honestly presented about those is those studies, again, point at city centers like Seattle, San Francisco, or Chicago. They don't point, because they can't point, to a broad geographic area, economically diverse area, like a state, because no one is far enough down the path to have had those impacts. Everything's relatively new. And so even the proponent's researcher for the city of Seattle noted that you cannot take the results of the city of Seattle and extrapolate that to the impact that it might have on a state, much for the differences that I pointed out just a few moments ago that the city of Chicago enjoys that no one else enjoys.
Well, Rob, thanks for taking the time to speak with us, sharing a little bit of your concerns this morning. I appreciate it.
Oh, Nyla, my pleasure. Thank you once again.
We'd love to hear your comments coming. Keep them coming on Twitter at 21STShow. That was Rob Carr, President and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Earlier this morning, I also had a chance to speak with Wendy Pollack. She's from the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. We spoke with Wendy as she was driving down to Springfield to be there for the signing. And Daisy Contreras also joined us. She's a reporter for NPR Illinois. Wendy, Daisy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us on this very busy morning for you guys.
Thank you for having me on.
Wendy, so this race has been a long time coming for advocates such as yourself. I wonder how you feel this morning as you're making the drive to Springfield, knowing this is going to be signed into law this morning.
Well, this is very exciting. I mean, minimum wage workers last got a raise back in 2010, and we have been working on a bill since that time, since 2011. So it's been a long time in coming. So I'm very excited, but I'm most excited for the workers because they will really benefit from this.
So I think lots of people always hear, Wendy, how they're always concerned, how many people are actually making minimum wage? It's a pretty small percentage of the labor market. How much of a difference do you think this will actually make to workers at this wage rate?
Well, it's going to make a tremendous impact because there's 1.4 million workers in Illinois who will get a raise as a result of this bill. I mean, it's not just folks who are currently earning the minimum wage of $8.25, but those who are earning less than $15 an hour. So for example, among women workers, 46% of them will see a wage, are earning less than $15 an hour right now, and will see a wage by the time it reaches $15 in 2015. 48% of African-American workers will see a raise, and 61% of Latino workers will receive a raise. But probably a statistic that's even more startling to most people, because they think of minimum wage as a wage for teenagers or a training wage, is that far more Illinois workers earning under $15 an hour are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. Over 70% are in that age range, far more than who are under 25 years old. So the typical Illinois worker earning less than $15 an hour is a woman who's over 25, has some college, is working full-time, and is likely to be a parent. So we are not just talking about teenagers. We are talking about adults who are working, who are earning less than $15 an hour now, who will see a raise sometime over the next 6 years.
Wendy, what would you say? Our listeners just heard us speak to Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. What would you say to folks like the Retail Merchants Association, the Restaurants Association, those who represent business, who say businesses simply can't afford this?
Well, the cost of living in this state right now, almost every area of the area of the state, people need at least $15 an hour to live, just to survive. It's not just the city of Chicago. The city of Chicago is higher than that. So, you know, it shouldn't be any business owner's plan to keep their workers earning poverty level wages. I mean, that's just not it just doesn't work for the workers, and it certainly doesn't work for Illinois. Illinois cannot afford to not do these raises.
That's Wendy Pollack with the Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. Wendy, thanks for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Wendy Pollack. We spoke with her this morning while she was on her way to Springfield. As we've been hearing, Governor J.B. Pritzker is signing a bill right now, which will increase the minimum wage here in Illinois to $15 by 2025. Daisy Contreras is with us. She's been reporting on this for NPR Illinois. Daisy, can we go over some of the details here? Because a lot of people are seeing headlines that say $15 an hour, but that doesn't happen until 2025.
Right. It's going to be incremental. Minimum wage workers will start seeing their increase beginning in January 2020. Right now the minimum rate is age 25. It'll go in January to 9.25, in July of that same year to $10, and then every year after that, $1 until hitting $15 in 2025.
So even though people are seeing this $15 headline, it's really going to be $10 next year, and then we'll increase a dollar a year after that.
That's correct, yes.
And so even though this bill doesn't include regional variations, that's been a lot of discussion, whether or not this bill, because some states do have that, different minimum wages for different parts of the city, different parts of the state, that's not the case here.
That is not, and that is something that the business groups, several business groups, wanted included in the bill. New York and Oregon are two states that already do a similar system where, by region, depending on cost of living, there's a different minimum wage. They fought for that to be included in the bill, but it was not included.
But the reality also, Daisy, is that the minimum wage is already higher in Chicago and Cook County, right? They have a higher minimum wage set?
That's right. Yes. So, you know, depending, so Chicago might decide to do something different, go at a different rate later. Different cities already have different rates.
So what concessions do you think were made to business, to big business in this bill, Daisy?
So advocates say that during the negotiation, so spreading this out over 6 years was one of the many compromises that they said they took. Businesses wanted a longer step increase, but advocates say they got 6 years. They also have a tip credit, which was supported by the Illinois Restaurant Association. The bill also creates a tax credit to help businesses with 50 or fewer employees in order to help them offset the costs of the wage increase. So employers would be able to claim a tax credit for 25% of the cost in 2020, and then the credit will go smaller, eventually phasing out every year after that.
Okay, so that are some of the concessions in there. I wonder, otherwise, apart from that, what the debate was like in the House when this passed, what we heard from both people supporting both business. So it's kind of two sides of this issue, right? People who are working, as we just heard from the Retail Merchants Association, as well as people who are working with folks who are impoverished or with the working poor.
Yeah, the House debate was heated, as it's expected, with issues such like these. It went almost for close to 3 hours. Business owners, some legislators are business owners. They represent Central and Southern Illinois. That's where most of the arguments came from, that businesses would not be able to sustain themselves because cost of living is lower in Central and Southern Illinois as opposed to, for example, the collar counties or Chicago. Farmers, those legislators representing areas with a large farming population, said that a lot of small farming businesses would not be able to sustain themselves and might be pushed to close. A lot of them wanted more time on the negotiating table with sponsors of the legislation. They wanted to come to a compromise. And it's very interesting listening to, for example, Leader Durkin, Jim Durkin, who said, well, you know,
Republican
at the beginning,
leader. Mm-hmm.
Republican leader Jim Durkin, yes, correct, saying that he wanted to come to a compromise to get Republicans on board with the legislation. And he said he was disappointed that this was something going against what Governor Pritzker had promised during his inauguration speech that he was going to work with both sides of the aisle. And Leader Durkin says this is going against that.
Well, we'll have to talk about more about that, particularly tomorrow, as Governor Pritzker presents his budget and the bipartisan work that he has promised. In the meantime, Daisy, this is for folks who are advocating for the working poor, like the Sergeant Shriver Center, talking about the millions of people who will be affected by this. And for Governor Pritzker, this is a really big win.
It is. I mean, Governor Pritzker, this was one of his campaign promises. And, you know, he, regardless of Republican support or not, he was going to go through with it. And I think that this bipartisan compromise is not, you know, it's not over, as Leader Durkin says it is. I think that moving forward, we're going to need a balanced budget. We're going to need a capital plan. And that's where a lot of Republicans will be able to voice their concerns and get what they want and what they need, because I don't think Governor Pritzker can do all of that by himself.
And in the meantime, today, Illinois will soon have a new minimum wage. J.C. Contreras is a reporter with NPR Illinois, joining us from the State House in Springfield. Daisy, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
As I said, we've been talking to you about this. It seems like our audience is just as divided on this. Kate says this is a bad idea. This is where, from some Facebook comments we got. Eric says people like Rob whine and cry about businesses going under every time anyone raises the minimum wage. Ever since I entered the workforce in 1980, there are still lots of small businesses out there. We always enjoy hearing your comments. You can go to our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can tweet us. We got some comments via Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow, and email. You can email us as well. Our email is talk@21stshow.org. Lots of ways to interact with us. We will take all of them. Coming up just after the break, stay close. We will talk about what's ahead for the budget address with the Civic Federation, what they'd like to see Governor Pritzker present tomorrow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tomorrow at noon, Governor J.B. Pritzker is scheduled to deliver his first budget address. What's new this year is that Democrats control every statewide office and command supermajorities in both chambers of the State House. But what hasn't changed is that Illinois is billions of dollars in the hole. Maybe you've heard Governor Pritzker talk about things like legalizing marijuana. How much revenue will that bring into Illinois? And how much will things like that really help our state's bottom line? The independent, nonpartisan Civic Federation has been advocating for some big changes for a while now, whether we're talking about taxing retirement income, changing pension benefits, or limiting public spending. Lawrence Massal is the Civic Federation's president. He's online with us now from Chicago to explain what he would like to hear the governor say tomorrow. Good morning, Lawrence. Welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Lawrence, I just want to start with something that you all wrote in your report that came out recently that outlines our fiscal challenges and priorities. And you wrote that Illinois' habit of hiding its long-term financial problems with budget gimmicks and illusory reforms must end. Can we talk about what kind of gimmicks you are seeing and concerned with?
Yes, we definitely can. So the state has a long and unfortunately expensive history of not accounting for the full cost of its government, not accounting for the cost of borrowing and ignoring our liabilities. So in our report that we issued last week, the Civic Federation urged the new governor and the new General Assembly to rely on standard accounting practices and a full assessment of what your known revenues and your known expenditure pressures are going to be.
And was there a sense that in the previous administration that was not happening?
Well, I think in a couple of the previous administrations that has been a problem. Such things as speculative pension savings, claiming that we're going to save hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes billions of dollars, and not have an actuarial study to justify it, is something that has been done in previous administrations, not paying the full actuarial amount of the pension cost, instead basically going on a schedule that allows for some budgetary relief now, but makes the cost of the pension program much more expensive in the future. or thinking that you're going to negotiate with the unions on very significant health insurance savings and putting that in the budget, but then that not be affected and us having to pay more in the future. Also lowering the funded target ratio. The state of Illinois operates with a plan to get to 90% funded over a 50-year time horizon.
And this is for pension liabilities, Lawrence?
This is for pension liabilities. Yeah. The other big thing that we tend to do is we overestimate what the revenue is going to be generated, whether it's what the standard income sales or other taxes are going to bring, or new taxes or new sin taxes. For instance, we completely, not this previous administration, but the one before Governor Quinn, totally overestimated what video poker would generate in terms of the state. And so we issued bonds based on for capital needs based on video poker revenues that never really materialized when they were needed. Now people are talking about recreational marijuana, sports gambling, and other sin taxes as a means of stabilizing the state's finances. Our call is to make sure that we know exactly how much revenue is going to be incorporated from those changes and that we not rely on speculative or wild estimates.
So let's take legalizing marijuana, because certainly that's something Governor Pritzker has talked about. I recall when I spoke to him about it, he had estimates of a couple, let's just say a couple $100 million we get in marijuana revenue should it be legalized. How much of a dent? So let's say, let's just say $300 million, Lawrence, even though I don't even know if how accurate that is. Let's say $300 million. How much would that make a dent in the revenue shortfall, the budget shortfall that faces stating this the state is facing right now?
Well, as Governor Rauner was leaving office, he estimated that the budget deficit for the current year was just over $1 billion, about $1.4 billion. And Governor Pritzker has recently indicated that they, in order to meet the demands that he sees for more education funding, both elementary and secondary and higher education, the helping various agencies of state government, that they look at a budget deficit of about $3 billion. So $300 million is about 10% of $3 billion. So while it's not, wouldn't be insignificant, it won't unto itself dramatically change the deficit. The state has over $7 billion in unpaid bills that it's going to drag into the new fiscal year. So again, $300 million will not significantly reduce that. We need a matching of the actual revenue with the expenditures that the state is going to identify for the coming year.
So let's talk about those revenues. So let's say we're looking at a $3 billion revenue gap right now, if that's the number that we're seeing. How do you all suggest the Civic Federation has a couple of proposals, ideas that certainly have been talked about in the legislature before? Where do you suggest we start looking for that revenue?
Well, first off, before we start looking for revenue, we got to stop digging the hole deeper. So we ask that they put a limit on the rate of growth of state agency spending. And so limit that to a reasonable rate of about 2.4% over the coming years for the next 5 years.
For all state agencies, Lawrence?
For all agencies of state government, yes. That is basically what's considered a maintenance level that previous Governor Rauner had identified and the legislature is familiar with. It's the reality that when you're in such a big hole, you can't keep making it larger and without having tremendous costs to the state. So once you do that, then we also believe that the state needs to consolidate its pension funds into more traditional, like other surrounding states like Wisconsin, in order to promote efficiency, better returns, and eliminate unnecessary costs. If you do that, then the state should look immediately at getting rid of the very generous exemption on retirement income that Illinois is one of the few states and the only one around in the surrounding Midwest that does not provide some taxation of retirement income. The federal government taxes retirement income, Wisconsin, all of our surrounding other states taxes. Illinois can't afford to give away what is basically a $2 billion tax exemption when it's basically having its taxpayers pay hundreds of millions and in some cases billions of dollars in interest on their unpaid bills.
So do we have a sense, so just to be clear, how much money do you think Illinois, or do we have an estimate of how much Illinois has missed out on by not taxing retirement income?
By not taxing it, and retirement income the way the federal government, the way our surrounding states would do it, Illinois is foregoing almost $2.5 billion a year in revenue.
So that's actually, Lawrence, that's a pretty, I'm just doing the math here. I mean, if we're looking, for example, first of all, at a $3 billion revenue gap, if we were to start taxing retirement income, and that's $2.5 billion, that gets us pretty close.
That would make a significant contribution to getting closer to balancing the budget. And it wouldn't require a constitutional amendment. It would require just a simple vote of a majority of the members of the Illinois General Assembly.
Lawrence, as you spend a lot of time at the Civic Federation, with the Civic Federation in Springfield, talking to lawmakers, what is your sense of whether or not taxing retirement income is something that will be on the table, could happen, could actually take effect?
I think when you look at the cold facts of the situation Illinois faces, when you talk to the more enlightened legislators who want to fix the problem, they recognize that the exemption on graduated income tax is totally out of whack with what the state of Illinois needs to do. That doesn't give them the political will to do it right on their own. They need the leadership of the governor. We need the governor on Wednesday to stand up and identify really what his vision is for moving Illinois forward. And if you're going to move Illinois forward, you're going to have to close whatever the deficit that you identify as. Is it $1.5 billion or is it $3 billion? Either one is going to require significant changes in state government, and it's likely going to require at least $1 billion in new income to the state that can be done not through legalization of marijuana or sports gambling, but has to go at the core taxing ability of the state, which is the generous exemptions that we allow in our income tax.
So, Lawrence, you've been focusing on things that the lawmakers can control. One thing that I think has been really hard for lawmakers to wrap their heads around is pensions, because there have been fixes that have been proposed that have since been deemed unconstitutional. So they've been overturned by the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. You all have long advocated for a constitutional amendment that would allow the state to change current retiree benefits.
Yes, the Civic Federation strongly supports an effort to put in front of the taxpayers the ability to change not the benefits that are the guarantee of benefits, but just the 3% compounded automatic increase that regardless of inflation, Illinois retirees receive a 3% compounded automatic increase. That is the most expensive type of benefit you can offer. Illinois is really one of the only states to offer such a statutory benefit like that. And since we have $130 billion in unfunded liability, which means we're $130 billion short on where we should be in funding our pensions, we need to be able to make that change. But if you take the position that we're not going to change any of the automatic increases, that we're not going to change the Constitution to allow that, the best thing you could do for the pensioners and the citizens of Illinois is to fully fund the pensions. And so not look for spreading out the payments later, trying to make it easier, reducing the funded ratio, anything that provides immediate budgetary relief. If you don't believe we can change the pension benefits, then you have a responsibility of fully funding the pensions, not continuing to kick the can down the road.
My guest is the Civic Federation's president, Lawrence Missal. They're an independent, nonpartisan group. As Lawrence has been sharing with us last week, they came out with their pretty detailed proposal for the state, what the state needs to do to try to resolve some of the very deep fiscal problems that we have. If you have questions or comments about this, as always, you're welcome to join us. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. If you want to give us a call, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21STShow. Lawrence, can I ask you just about the whole idea of the mood in the Capitol now? We were just listening to the president of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We were hearing from Daisy Contreras about Republican leader Durkin saying he feels like this minimum wage increase was passed not in a bipartisan way. I wonder what you think from your discussions with lawmakers, what the collaborative spirit is like right now in Springfield for actually getting something done this year in terms of budgets and negotiations.
Well, Illinois is the only state where it's a debate as to whether or not you're going to have a budget or not. 49 other states routinely establish a budget to set the spending priorities for the state.
Do you think that shouldn't be a question this year? Do you think that's going to be a question this year?
It should not be a question. No. Okay. I think that basically Governor Pritzker clearly wants to have a budget. I think the General Assembly members that return learned from the very expensive mistake of not having a budget for 2 years. So I think we're ready to move forward. The question is, will Illinois have a budget that's actually balanced and that improves the state's fiscal position, or will it be reliant on gimmicks and things that are not likely to improve the state's financial position? Illinois has the worst rated credit of any state in the United States. That is a dangerous and expensive place to be. Illinois has almost $7 billion in unpaid bills right now. That's very expensive because we pay very high interest costs. So hopefully the governor, working with the legislature, will come closer to balancing the budget through known revenues and through known expenditures. State law requires that the governor, when he steps up to the podium tomorrow, can only rely on revenue that already exists for the state of Illinois in proposing his balanced budget. How this new governor, Pritzker, is going to do that is something that everybody's watching and looking forward to, not out of envy, but out of basically curiosity of how you can close such a large budget deficit, whether you will rely on new taxes, dramatic cuts in government services, or something else.
So, Lawrence, as you pointed out, not just Governor Rauner, Governor Quinn, governors of both parties have not been particularly forthcoming in the budget address about the situation that we're facing. What would you, in a perfect world, what would you like to hear Governor Pritzker say tomorrow that would satisfy that we're actually dealing with the problem?
I would like to see that the governor provides a reasonable assessment what our known revenues are, what our revenues potentially could be going forward this year, and what our expenditures can be. Right now, the state of Illinois has expected revenues of about $37.6 billion. And at a minimum, we're hearing of plans for $40 billion plus in spending. In order to do that, in order to meet the state law requirement of a balanced budget, the governor is going to have to identify where he's going to cut spending for the state of Illinois. In addition, the pension crisis is what drives so much of Illinois' financial expense. What is the governor's plan with 25% of all available revenues right now going into pension and pension-related debt? What is his idea and vision for reducing that in the future, or at least finding the resources to fully pay for it?
One last question for you, Lawrence. I think many of the people who are listening are aware of the problems that Illinois has. I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen total honesty and transparency from governors in the past, because it is a problem and people don't want to think about having to pay more money to solve it. But I wonder what your case is to Illinoisans who are listening, that whether we're talking about modifying pension benefits, introducing new taxes, cutting spending, what's your case that in the long run this is good for everyone and for the whole state?
The sooner Illinois gets real about its pension and its budget and its funding requirements, the sooner we'll be able to invest in the things that we all believe is important, whether it's education, higher education, public safety. But right now, Illinois pays more than any other state for its government because it is so badly financed. We're paying exorbitant interest rates on $7 billion in unpaid bills. We're not investing in infrastructure. We haven't had a major capital or infrastructure plan in over 8 years. What we have done in the past for capital has been gimmicks such as video poker and other things. We're going to have to be realistic. Look at the gas tax. Recognize that there are a lot of priorities around the state of Illinois and some that are in critical need of repair, and those should be first rather than non-priority items.
We'll be listening for those specifics tomorrow then. That's Lawrence Massal, who's president of the Civic Federation. Lawrence, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Coming up, stay tuned to the 21st. We're going to be talking about the most recent measles cases that have been reported here in Illinois, actually right here in Champaign-Urbana, 4 cases. Dr. David Chan from Carl is going to be joining us to talk about that. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Many people around the world are dying of a preventable disease that's measles. About 130 people in the Philippines, more than 900 people in Madagascar have died in recent outbreaks. We're also having measles cases reported here in the U.S. To be clear, no one has died in this country, but the CDC says there have been about 130 cases since the beginning of 2019. Washington State has declared a state of emergency. Lawmakers are urging people there to make sure their children get the measles vaccine. And now we have 4 cases in Illinois, all in Champaign-Urbana. The CU Public Health District said on Sunday that patients are no longer in the infectious stage, but is unclear if anyone else has been exposed. All of this is happening, even though the measles, mumps, rubella vaccination is widely available and effective at preventing this disease. So to join us to talk about this is Dr. David Chan, the Medical Director of Pediatrics for Carl Foundation Hospital here in Urbana. Good morning, Dr. Chan. Thank you for being with me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
First, I think it was startling to me to hear that people are actually dying from measles in 2019. Across the world. Do you think that people in America realize the seriousness of measles?
You know, this is one of the potential side effects of the fact that we've actually had this disease almost eradicated in the United States. And I think most of the present generation of parents with young children never experienced the seriousness of this disease. And unless you are specifically personally involved with other people who travel to these places, you don't understand that this potentially is a lethal disease and also potentially will cause permanent brain damage because of its effects on the brain when a person has been infected with measles.
So do we know how people in the U.S. are contracting measles?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of theories, and certainly the fact is that we have had some recent movements in our country of many parents choosing not to vaccinate the kids. And once you're vaccinated, even though you may have come in contact with potentially somebody traveling from afar who has an active disease, you're not actually able to spread that virus because your body will not sort of replicate the virus, and then therefore you are not somebody who's infectious. So most of the time, those are isolated cases, and they do not get spread. But now you do have people in this country who are unvaccinated, and that is a perfect setup that all you need is one case, and then it starts spreading. And that's why we're beginning to see the resurgence of a disease that, frankly, for the last couple of generations, we rarely ever saw this problem.
So, Dr. Chan, do we know at what rate people are being vaccinated in Champaign County?
The good news is that we actually have a very high rate of vaccination, and I applaud the young families out there who have children that I think our rate of vaccination is greater than 90%. We wish it was 100%, and we, as an organization working with the other health entities, so Christie as well as OSF, are working to try to contact families who are overdue for the MMR vaccination and try to get them in as soon as possible so they can be vaccinated. And we know that the good news about the vaccination, too, is that it's highly effective. And so we just need to get them in so they can get this shot to protect the children.
So according to the CDC, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine has about a 97% effectiveness. Dr. Chan, at what age should we be getting that MMR vaccination, do you recommend?
Right. The standard recommendation based on both the CDC as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics is that otherwise healthy children should be getting them somewhere between 12 to 15 months, and again from 4 to 6 years of age as a second shot. We have had certain circumstances where we may give it younger, but unfortunately when you give it less than 12 months, the science suggests that they may not have a adequate full response, and they still will need to get that shot at 12 to 15 months as regularly scheduled. So that's one of the things that have been discussed with the leaders, is that our first priority is really getting these kids in who will have the best response to the vaccination and get them into the system as soon as possible.
So I wonder if we can just end it by me asking you about the whole idea. I think people have heard the term herd immunity, but you're saying, so for example, babies that are less than 12 months cannot be there. We don't recommend that they're vaccinated. So there is a whole year where babies, even if they could be, even if parents were willing to vaccinate them, they are not. That's not happening. So they have babies have a year of being maybe possibly contagious. Why is it important then that a high percentage of people get the MMR vaccine? Because how does one person not getting the vaccine affect everyone or have a greater effect on just that one person?
Yeah, to be clear, the vaccine is not going to be effective in babies that are less than 6 months of age. We do know they have a partial response from 6 to 12 months, and they have the best response at 12 months and older. But the reason for this is that if you have a group of people that's no longer vaccinated, now those people, it's like a pyramid. It can spread from one person to another because it is extremely contagious. The virus can hang out on surfaces for more than 2 hours, even though the person may have left. And it doesn't take much for someone to contract the disease if they're not protected. The idea here is that if you have most people vaccinated, like it has been in previous generations when this vaccine became available, is that even if you have that odd case that does present itself in the public, the rest of the people will not contract the disease, and therefore they will not pass it on to anybody else. And this is the challenge that we have in front of us, is how to contain this to the minimal number of folks. And our advice to people is that if they think they have contracted, been exposed to the measles, is that they need to contact their healthcare provider so they can make arrangements to be evaluated and potentially be given some advice regarding either vaccination or supportive care, because there is no medicines that cures measles, and people we need to just allow the disease to run its course.
Dr. Chan, we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you very quickly, for folks who are listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, it seems that from the public health standpoint that these cases perhaps have been contained, but what are the signs for people that people need to be careful about if they've been exposed and clearly, obviously, if they haven't gotten the vaccine?
Right. The symptoms of measles are pretty classic. It's usually a rash with tiny red bumps. It usually starts up in the face and then it sort of spreads downward to the neck, arms, legs. And always they will have a high fever. They will cough, runny nose, and red, watery eyes. Those are sort of the classic example of that. I think given the seriousness of this, the advice I have is that if you haven't been vaccinated, get vaccinated. If you think you might have the disease, contact your healthcare provider, and they will help you take the next appropriate steps.
Dr. David Chan is the Medical Director of Pediatrics for Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Dr. Chan, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to spread the word.
In recent years, more people have been using lithium-ion batteries. You're probably closer to a lithium battery than you might realize. Just check your pocket for your phone. But until last week, the vast majority of those batteries had to be sent outside the U.S. to be recycled. But now, the U.S. Department of Energy has launched Recell. It's the first lithium-ion battery recycling center, and it's based right here in Illinois at Argonne National Labs. That means not just reusing materials for batteries for phones, but even electric cars. For more on this, I'm joined on the line now by Jeff Spangenberger. He's the director of the new resale center at Argonne. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So I wondered if I could just ask you why it's important to have a recycling center in the U.S. here for these batteries?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the number of batteries is growing very quickly. Everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has a computer. And more people are buying electric vehicles. So there's a growing need to do something with the end of the, with the batteries at the end of life for these vehicles and other devices. The materials that go into all of these batteries are predominantly sourced from other countries outside of the United States, and these have been labeled as critical materials, specifically lithium, cobalt, and graphite. Natural graphite are critical materials. The resale center is working to make the U.S. Globally competitive for battery recycling. Right now, a lot of these batteries are being shipped out of the country to be reused. So once we can actually make this profitable, and I'll say now that you can currently recycle. You may see places at stores to bring your batteries, and these batteries can be recycled, lithium-ion batteries, but it's not profitable to do so right now. And so we're working to actually make battery recycling of these lithium-ion batteries profitable. So now that we have these materials here, if we can be globally competitive and make money doing this, we're going to need manufacturers here to make new batteries, which we also don't do currently in the United States.
And so it sounds like, it sounds like the problem is that it's just too expensive right now in the U.S. to recycle these batteries, and that's what you guys are working on, hopefully a way to make this a more cost-effective recycling method?
Exactly.
And I wonder why you think that's important for us to be doing this here in the U.S.
Well, as I mentioned, the materials come from other countries, that we source them from other countries. So once we buy them from another country, buy them in a battery form or raw materials, we send them back. And so once we have the material here, it would be great if we can keep the material here so that we don't have to keep going back and buying these materials from other countries.
Mm-hmm. And what does all of this have to do with electric cars? I know that the part of this announcement was made at the Chicago Auto Show, right?
That's right. So right now, the biggest contributor of lithium-ion batteries or user of lithium-ion batteries is your cell phones and your computers. But if anybody has gone to the auto show, there's a lot of buzz going on right now about electric vehicles and how companies are going electric. And so pretty soon, electric vehicles are going to be the biggest contributor of lithium-ion batteries.
And so the idea is that you all or Argonne National Labs wants to also get in on that market as well and hopefully being able to recycle those batteries?
Exactly right. So the chemistries are very similar between electric vehicles as well compared to the cell phones and computers. The Department of Energy has really done a good job to foot the bill to do this work. This isn't being done currently by industry. And so because of the risk, it's a high-risk, high-reward proposition. And so the Department of Energy is paying to de-risk this research.
Mm, right. We were actually talking to the head of the National Science Foundation about this last week, about investment and whether or not this is something that the private sector would do. And it sounds like this is something that you feel like is good for a government-funded lab to do because, as you said, it's high-risk, high-reward.
That's right. So a lot of the work that we do at Argonne and the other national laboratories, and I'd also like to point out that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory as well as Oak Ridge National Laboratory and some other universities are involved in this. This is a collaboration. But we work closely with industry because the work that we do here we want to make sure is relevant to industry. And at the end of the day, at the end of this project, we want industry to take this to commercialization.
That's Jeff Spangenberger. He's the director of the new resale center at Argonne National Laboratory, as we've been talking about the first lithium-ion battery recycling center in the U.S., based right here in Illinois. Jeff, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
That does it for us today. One more comment from a listener in regards to the segment we were talking about with the budget. We've got a comment on Twitter that if you tax my pensions, I am moving to Florida. We're not. I don't know if we're necessarily talking about taxing pensions. I think more retirement incomes, but clarification there. We're going to be hearing more about this tomorrow. We will be live from Springfield, from the state capitol, broadcasting from inside the state house as Governor Pritzker presents his first budget address. We'll have a special hour of the 21st ahead of that noon budget address, speaking with lawmakers, including Comptroller Susana Mendoza, House Republican Leader Jim Durkin. We were talking about him earlier today. Both of them, a few other folks, are going to be joining us. That does it for us today. As always, we love interaction, as you've been hearing during the show. We've been reading comments from you on Facebook, on Twitter, email. If you go to 21stshow.org, that's the best way to interact with us, and you can find our social media handles, ways to leave us voicemails, send us emails. All that is at 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwain is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comms from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.